Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's July 17th, 1955, in Anaheim, California, at the happiest place on Earth. Two men stand in front of Sleeping Beauty's castle. Walt Disney, the world-class entertainer, and his good friend, TV personality Art Linkletter, the host of Dateline Disney, a live TV special covering Disneyland's opening day. It's the final shot of the 90-minute broadcast. Art puts his arm around Walt and wraps up the show.
Let's go into Fantasyland and have fun.
Goodbye, folks.
As the two men turn from the camera and walk towards the castle, Walt is all smiles. The Dateline Disney broadcast has been a tremendous success. 90 million Americans tuned in to get a glimpse of Walt's newest creation. 90 million potential customers. But underneath his famous smile, Walt is fuming. Throughout the day, as Walt ran from place to place, frantically changing costumes and hustling to make the next shot, he began to hear rumors of problems in the park. 10,000 people were invited to the soft opening, but nearly 30,000 showed up. Fistfights broke out in the sweltering 100-degree heat. Rides broke down. Restaurants ran out of food. Lines were so long, many guests gave up and went home. All the while, Walt was forced to smile for the cameras and put on a happy face. But after the broadcast, when Walt bursts into the office of Disneyland's general manager, C.B. Wood, he isn't smiling anymore.
What in the hell's going on out there, Woody?
Calm down, Walt.
Don't tell me to calm down. The Mark Twain steamboat sank. Mr. Toad's wild ride didn't make it past lunch. And I hear the lines to the restroom are so long, people are going on the trees.
It's the first day, Walt. Hiccups are to be expected.
There was a gas leak at Fantasyland. We're lucky the place didn't go up in flames.
I don't have to tell you that there's press out there, Woody. National press.
Out of the 10,000 invited guests, many were journalists. Walt has banked his reputation and his livelihood on Disneyland. He invested his own money, selling a vacation home and borrowing against a life insurance policy. The last thing he needs is a slew of bad reviews or bad word of mouth from tens of thousands of uninvited guests.
We just weren't ready for this, Walt. You weren't ready for this. You're the general manager, Woody. This park is your responsibility. We'll get this corrected. Tomorrow is the official public opening. That means paying customers. I won't stomach a repeat of what happened here today. Do you understand me?
Yes, Mr. Disney.
Turn this around, or we'll all be looking at the unemployment line.
Walt would forever refer to Disneyland's opening day as Black Sunday. The reviews the next morning were scathing, calling the park a disappointment, a nightmare, and a $17 million people trap. But with his reputation and his fortune on the line, Walt was determined to turn things around. And he did it fast. He made personnel changes at the top, eventually firing his general manager, C.B. Wood. He brought on more staff to handle the crowds, and he launched bigger and better attractions. Soon enough, Walt's efforts began to pay off. By the end of September, the 1 millionth visitor entered the park. By the end of 1955, Walt's company had taken in $24 million, over twice the revenue from the previous year. But Walt was also a perfectionist. He relished his victories, but he obsessed over his mistakes. And Disneyland had been riddled with them. Which is why Walt Disney was so eager to try it all again. As he set his sights on creating a second theme park, Walt was determined to achieve perfection, to build a park that was 10 times the size of Disneyland, and hopefully 10 times the profit.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Behind every successful business is a story. It begins with a vision and then a leap of faith. Along the way, people make bold decisions, ride through booms and busts, and sometimes they find success. Before I began hosting shows like American Scandal, American History Tellers, and producing audio dramas like 1865, I got my master's in business because I've always been interested in how businesses work, how they grow, how they thrive. In business school, we looked at case studies. How did this business succeed? Why did that business fail? On Business Movers, we'll ask those same questions, and we'll dive into the true stories of the brilliant but all too human business leaders who risked it all, the critical moments that led to their triumph or failure, and the ideas that transformed the way we live our lives. We begin with a 4-episode series about Walt Disney and what drove his desire to build a bigger and better theme park in Orlando, Florida. Walter Walt Elias Disney once wrote, "We don't look backwards for very long. We keep moving forward, opening up new doors and doing new things because we're curious, and curiosity keeps leading us down new paths." But Walt Disney's path was littered with failures. After being fired from the Kansas City Star for lacking imagination, Walt struck out on his own and started an animation company called Laugh-O-Gram Studios. But within 2 years, it was upside down. Still, Walt persisted. He learned from his mistakes. He adapted and evolved. Eventually, he rose from bankrupt entrepreneur to arguably the greatest showman of all time. Walt was a man of extraordinary vision. He had a unique ability to imagine what many others could not see. His grand vision was always his North Star. In 1923, that vision led Walt to Hollywood, where he'd eventually create a cartoon mouse that sparked the golden age of animation. That same year, it drove Walt to found the studio that would become the Walt Disney Company, and helped Walt produce over 150 films and win 32 Academy Awards, the most ever earned by a single individual. And in 1955, that vision helped Walt launch the first of what would ultimately be 12 Disney-themed amusement parks scattered at resorts all across the globe. In 2019, Disneyland hosted nearly 20 million visitors, and since its launch in 1955, Disneyland has been the heart of the Disney brand and one of its biggest sources of revenue. Disneyland is the happiest place on earth, but it's also a business. And Walt, the shrewd entrepreneur, was a cutthroat businessman, driven by a bold vision and a relentless pursuit of a better bottom line. While Walt's movies were critically acclaimed, they didn't always make money. But after Disneyland got over its rocky start, it made money, and a lot of it. In 1957 alone, the park grossed more than $11 million, well over $100 million today. But Walt was not motivated by dollars alone. He was also driven by a desire for perfection. Once at a showing of Fantasia, when a journalist asked Walt why he was rearranging chairs at his own movie screening, Walt replied, "Because I like things just so." Walt's desire for perfection drove him to improve on Disneyland and create a second theme park. As he searched for the perfect location, Walt envisioned something bigger and better than Disneyland, something new and something perfect, a total destination resort, a city of tomorrow. This is Episode 1, Project Future. It's November 1963 in St. Louis, Missouri. Walt Disney has come to town 9 months after construction began on the Gateway Arch, America's tallest man-made monument. St. Louis is a town on the rise, and today Disney brings with him the potential for another massive project, a second Disney theme park. The finances are sorted, the paperwork's been drafted. All that's left is to put pen to paper, which is why Walt Disney, his executives, and a group of local politicians and business leaders have gathered for a celebratory dinner. Walt sits at the head of the table. He looks dapper, with his neatly groomed mustache and slick, graying hair. All smiles, Walt proposes a toast. Here's to a bright and successful future and a fruitful partnership. After considering upwards of a dozen cities, Walt chose St. Louis, in no small part because the locals have been easy to work with. But that's all about to change, because there's one dinner guest who is not smiling. August Gussie Bush Jr., the successful St. Louis beer magnate. Gussie is clearly skeptical of Walt Disney's theme park, and he's about to blow the deal.
Well, Mr. Disney, looks like everything's in place, but what about liquor?
I beg your pardon?
You heard me?
Gussie's blunt question sucks the air out of the room, and it steals the smile off Walt's face.
Booze is my business, and St. Louis is my town. If you're going to be coming here, I'd at least like to know what your distribution plan is.
Sitting nearby, the local mayor tries to intervene.
Well, now, Mr. Bush, I believe that question has already been answered, hasn't it, Walt?
It has. Walt's position on liquor is non-negotiable. As long as he's around, it will never be sold on Disney property. Walt believes liquor would cheapen the Disney image and the family-friendly Disney brand. But Walt doesn't say a word to Gussie. He quietly listens as the brash Mr. Bush presses the issue.
I think liquor is critical. Like I said, the question's already been answered. Then we ought to revisit the issue, Mr. Mayor. The fact is, any man who thinks he can design an attraction that is going to be a success in this city and not serve beer or liquor ought to have his head examined.
It's an outrageous taunt, but Walt doesn't blow his top. He hardly shows any emotion at all. He simply raises his right eyebrow. The Disney executives in the room have seen this look before, and they know exactly what it means. Walt is livid. Later that night, Walt returns to his hotel suite across town. One of his executives walks into his room.
Good night, Mr. Disney. What time can we have the plane in the morning?
The plane? We have a meeting in the morning. We're supposed to...
Forget about that. It's finished. We're not going to that meeting. Have the plane ready first thing.
Whether or not Walt Disney abandoned St. Louis because of Gussie Bush's offensive comment is not entirely known. But what is known by all of us is that no Disney theme park was built in St. Louis. And the story about Disney and Gussie Bush illustrates a critical fact about the man many called Uncle Walt. He was a hard-nosed businessman who did not back down. Walt was determined that Disney World would eventually eclipse Disneyland, and to achieve that goal, he would embrace what worked the first time and improve on what didn't. The liquor policy was essential. The family-friendly Disney brand was more precious to Walt than any possible location for the park, no matter how accommodating. But the most important lesson Walt had learned the first time around was not about booze. It was about the importance of keeping a secret. Walt never forgot or forgave the embarrassment of Black Sunday, Disneyland's opening in California. But when he looked to build a second theme park, there was a business consideration that drove him even more: land and profits. Walt had tried to keep the Anaheim project under wraps. He had planned to buy up the land surrounding the park, develop it over time, and increase his profits as the theme park's success increased the value of the surrounding area. But Walt failed to keep it under wraps. Word leaked out. Speculators swooped in, bought up the surrounding area, and priced Walt out. Walt despised what he called the neon jungle of lucrative hotels, restaurants, and shops that popped up all along the edges of the Southern California park, all of which spoiled his idyllic vision for Disneyland and also deprived him of business opportunities. For his next park, Walt was focused on making sure the project stayed secret long enough for him to find the perfect location and buy up the surrounding land. This time, there would be no neon jungle. The only thing surrounding the park would be acres of green that Walt controlled. To achieve this goal, Walt kept his circle close. He assembled a lean, expert team of colleagues he could rely on, and he gave the project a top-secret codename. Several titles were considered, and some were used along the way. Project X, Project Winter, Project Summer, Project Spring. But ultimately, the final name was reflective of Walt's grand vision for what he called a city of tomorrow, Project Future. Walt's ideas went through a rigorous creative process that often involved collaborators and frequently began with market research. One of his most trusted partners was the talented research economist Harrison Buzz Price. If Walt was the creative genius, Buzz was the researcher-in-chief. Buzz looked the part of a data man, with his baby face and bookish glasses. But Walt trusted Buzz implicitly. Buzz had helped Walt settle on Anaheim as the location for Disneyland. And for his second part to succeed, Walt would need Buzz to help him find another perfect location. Walt had been toying with the idea of Florida since as far back as 1959. He developed a growing interest in urban development and had commissioned Buzz to do a study on the viability of building a community of tomorrow in Palm Beach, Florida. For the Palm Beach project, Walt had envisioned a theme park unlike any other, 400 acres with a town center at its heart that could hold upwards of 70,000 people. He had been so passionate that he commissioned artful renderings and intricate, detailed drawings. Though the Palm Beach project never came to fruition, it and a report Buzz produced called The Economic Setting of the City of Tomorrow was the kernel of an idea that would eventually become Walt's Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow, or EPCOT. 4 years later, in November of 1963, Buzz took Walt and members of the Project Future team on a plane tour. They flew to Niagara Falls, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C., but Florida was always at the top of the list. The Sunshine State was appealing even if its beaches weren't. Walt knew that no theme park could compete with the natural beauty of a sandy waterfront, so he didn't want to be anywhere near the ocean. Plus, Walt's primary goal was to open a park and expand it in all directions, which meant the park needed to be inland, and it needed to be built on large swaths of flat, uninhabited land, and Central Florida had plenty of that. Walt had read troves of top-secret internal documents on the prospects of Florida, but to truly imagine the region's potential as the location for Disney World, he wanted to see the land for himself. On Thursday, November 21st, 1963, Walt, Buzz, and his team landed at Orlando's Executive Airport. They piled into rental cars and drove straight to a hotel. To avoid unwanted attention, Walt checked in under a false name. But Walt was a famous man with a recognizable face. He'd already been hosting the wonderful World of Disney for a decade. That night at dinner, the waitress figured him out and asked for an autograph. She was likely confused when he signed William Brown. After touring the surrounding area by car, the next day, Walt and his team boarded a private plane and flew over Central Florida to give Walt a bird's-eye view. When he looked down and saw the empty, flat lands and never-ending fields of orange groves, he simply said, "That's it." On the flight back to California, Walt made the announcement. Central Florida had won the day. When they got back, Walt ordered Buzz Price to get to work immediately. Buzz came back with a proposal to authorize his company to scout lands in Central Florida, not Disney's, because by using his company, Buzz could keep Disney's involvement a secret. On November 27, 1963, in Conference Room 2E at Disney headquarters in Burbank, Buzz Price led a meeting with Walt and several Disney executives in the know. Buzz handed each attendee a copy of his proposal. The plan was simple: discreetly identify large parcels of land big enough to contain Walt's vision for the park. As the meeting wrapped up, Buzz gathered up the copies of the proposal. A Disney official pulled Buzz aside and told him to guard the proposal, make sure they didn't fall into the wrong hands. He was clearly worried about an internal leak. As always, money was at the heart of Project Future. If word got out, it would be like Anaheim all over again, with land speculators buying up the land before Walt could. Walt and Buzz swore the lawyers, researchers, and Disney executives to secrecy, but that wasn't enough. Walt would not rely solely on discretion. To protect his bottom line and keep Project Future a secret, Walt would lean on a man he knew he could trust, a man who had made a career of keeping secrets and gathering information, a former U.S. spy.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's winter 1963 at Disney headquarters in Burbank, California. Dick Morrow, general counsel for the Walt Disney Company, is on an important phone call with a lawyer at a powerful law firm, Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine.
Yeah, hello.
Yeah, this is Dick Morrow with Disney Productions.
Hi, Dick. What can I do for you?
Need your help. This will, of course, require your discretion. Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine, Disney's high-profile law firm in New York, is the place Walt calls when he needs to get something big done, especially something that requires secrecy, because Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine is more than a typical corporate law firm. It was founded by the man they called Wild Bill Donovan, a World War II spy. Today, Donovan's firm carries on the tradition by specializing in clandestine operations.
I see. And what's this regarding?
The project down in Florida.
Of course, Dick. All right. Well, tell me what you need.
We're sending Buzz Price's landman from ERA down to Florida to scout for properties.
What's his name?
William Lund.
Well, Mr. Lund has to be careful what he says and to whom he says it. I presume he understands this?
He's been instructed not to identify himself as having any connection to ERA or Disney.
Oh, well, we're going to have to do better than that.
Well, that's why I'm calling. What else can we do?
He needs an identity.
What are you thinking?
Business cards. If anyone asks, he'll say he's representing a firm in New York.
Won't your firm tie back to Disney?
No, he won't be with Donovan and partners. He'll be William Lund of Burke and Burke.
Who the hell's Burke and Burke?
The law firm one floor down. I'll speak to them. If anyone from Florida tries to reach Lund at his New York office, they'll go along. And I'll make sure Lund is notified of all communications out of the Burke office.
Well, thank you for this. Walt and I really appreciate everything the firm is doing to help with this project.
What project, Dick?
During World War II, William Wild Bill Donovan worked with the OSS, a precursor to the CIA, to spearhead intelligence operations in Europe. After the war, Wild Bill became a lawyer in New York and founded Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine. For Project Future, the team of lawyers at Donovan's firm knew just the man for the job, a Miami lawyer and another former OSS spy named Paul Helliwell. Paul Helliwell didn't look like a master spy. With his slick back hair and dark, thick-rimmed glasses, he looked like any other Florida businessman with a suit and a briefcase. But he was anything but. His work with the CIA continued well into the 1960s. And in the spring of 1964, the team at Donovan, Leisure, Newton, and Irvine sent an associate to meet with Paul Helliwell at his Miami office. There, he briefed Helliwell in. Disney was building a secret destination resort in Florida. Walt needed Helliwell to scout properties on the sly. Massive properties, 7 to 10,000 acres each. Helliwell understood the need for secrecy, but he did have one recommendation, to bring in a local real estate agency. While the Disney rep flew back to California to get permission to expand the team, Helliwell went to work. He was careful not to tell anyone who he was working with or what he was working on, and he went to great lengths to ensure that the details of his top-secret mission didn't find their way to the press. And as Paul Helliwell began to set up a series of shell corporations to buy the land, Buzz Price sent his associate William Lund to Florida. Lund arrived in Tampa on December 9, 1963, with a fake identity and fake Burke and Burke business cards to back it up. Lund's mission was simple. Walt was trying to choose between two Central Florida locations, Ocala and Orlando. Lund needed to get more details to help him decide, while also maintaining absolute secrecy. So Lund's first objective was to take Helliwell's advice and rope in a local real estate agency into the project. Based on a recommendation from a local banker in the know, Lund zeroed in on a company called Florida Ranch Lands, or the FRL. The day he arrived, Lund cold-called the FRL and spoke to an agent named David Nusbickle, who invited Lund to drop by their offices. At the meeting, Lund played his part well. After slipping Nusbickle his Burke and Burke business card, Lund explained that he represented a confidential client who was interested in purchasing large parcels of land in the Central Florida area. Nusbickle assured Lund that the FRL was well-equipped to help his anonymous client, and the two men agreed to meet again. But Nusbickle's curiosity was piqued. He asked his in-house lawyer to look into the mysterious Mr. Lund from New York. The lawyer reported back that Burke & Burke was a legitimate firm, and thanks to Paul Helliwell, Lund's cover held up. On his December trip to Florida, Lund drove all over Ocala and Orlando, two areas that looked a lot alike. Both were flat and largely uninhabited. In 1963, more people lived in the Los Angeles area surrounding Disneyland than the entire state of Florida, much less these two remote patches. Walt wanted Disney World to be the tourist destination for the entire East Coast, a total destination resort, which made access critical to the park's success. In January of 1964, not long after his trip to Florida, William Lund and Buzz Price met with Walt and other Project Future team members. In Conference Room 2E at Disney headquarters, they went over the findings of their research, and the result was clear. Orlando had won the day. Later, when asked what drew him to Orlando, Walt answered simply, "The freeway." What a difference just 2 years had made. Because back in 1961, Buzz Price had prepared a report for Walt that claimed that the Ocala area was the best location for a theme park because of the large number of out-of-state visitors who drove near the city annually. But by December of 1963, two major highways in the Orlando area were close to completion, Interstate 4 and the extension of the Florida Turnpike. These new stretches of asphalt made Orlando the clear winner. And so Walt's team of researchers, lawyers, and former spies laid the groundwork for Project Future. The Disney team brought the local real estate company FRL into the project's confidence and used them to secure the land. But as the top-secret project moved closer and closer to the finish line, rumors began to swirl. Locals whispered about the secret identity of the mysterious businessman who was buying up massive tracts of property in Central Florida. At first, these rumors traveled word of mouth, but it wouldn't be long before they found their way into black and white.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great-tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
It's summer 1965 at the offices of Florida Ranchlands, or FRL, a Florida real estate company. Nelson Boyce, the president of FRL, sits across his desk from a potential client who walked in off the street. Typically, FRL represents big companies and big buyers, not random walk-ins. But a customer is a customer, so Boyce spreads a map of Central Florida out on his desk and does his best to be polite.
"Well, thank you for coming in, sir."
"Well, thank you for making time to speak with me."
"Of course. At FRL, we aim to please."
"So, Mr. Boyce, I'm dying to know. What do you know about the mystery buyer, the one who's been buying up all the land in Central Florida?"
"Well, only what I've read in the papers."
Boyce is lying. FRL represents the mystery buyer. Although until recently, Boyce didn't know he was working for Walt Disney. He was kept in the dark until he earned Disney's trust. Now that he's been fully brought in, he understands that for Walt Disney, secrecy is paramount.
"So you don't represent the mystery buyer, then?"
The blunt question catches Boyce by surprise. He proceeds with caution.
"Where did you say you were from, friend?"
"California."
"Ah, you're a long way from home."
"Well, I was in Florida on business. Just flew in from Tampa. I was looking out the window on my flight in, and I couldn't help but notice how beautiful this area is."
"Well, that it is. Anything in particular of interest?"
"Well, there was one piece of land that caught my eye. I'm interested in buying right about here." The man taps his finger on a parcel of land right next to the proposed Disney site. Boyce eyes the man suspiciously. There's no way this is a coincidence. This man is either a land speculator looking to get rich off Disney's plan, or he's a reporter looking to blow the lid off of it. But either way, Boyce is determined to play it cool.
"Yes, plenty of land available in these parts. What's so special about this spot?"
"I just like the look of it. Saw it from the plane. The citrus groves are beautiful." And now Boyce is sure this man's a fraud. Bad weather recently destroyed most of the citrus groves in this particular area. Boyce doesn't know what this man's agenda is or who he is, but he's not taking any chances. So he folds up the map.
"All right, then. Well, I'll show you out."
"Is there a problem?"
"No problem. I'm willing to pay good money."
"No, I'm sorry. I just can't help you." Only minutes after the man left the building, Nelson Boyce reported the incident to Disney headquarters. Immediately, Walt launched an investigation, hoping to root out the source of the leak. The identity of the leaker was never discovered, but the damage was done. Word got out, and it traveled far and wide. And before long, the rumor that Walt Disney was the mystery buyer made its way to the local press. By the summer of 1965, Project Future was closing in on its goal. As the team quietly worked to acquire over 20,000 acres of land, rumors were rampant, and theories about the mystery company began to circulate. Lots of names were bandied about: Hughes Tool, Hercules Powder, McDonald Aircraft. A local news station even announced that they'd received a telegram from Detroit confirming that the mystery buyer was none other than the Ford Motor Company. But the next day, they were forced to admit they'd fallen prey to a hoax when a second telegram came in from Detroit claiming Ford needed the Florida land to grow hay to feed its large stable of Mustangs. But in the midst of a flurry of rumors, one newspaper was closing in on the truth. On a trip to Cape Cod, after being asked point-blank if he was the mystery buyer, Walt told the Orlando Sentinel that he was already spending $50 million to expand his California attraction and had neither the time nor the talent to look for a second venture. Disney momentarily succeeded in convincing the Sentinel that he had his hands full with Disneyland. And so on May 20, 1965, the Sentinel published a story that began, "There has been one consistent rumor that the land is being purchased for a second East Coast Disneyland attraction, but little credence is given this." But the Sentinel's gossip columnist, Charlie Wadsworth, didn't buy it. 1 month later, in June of 1965, Wadsworth wrote, "Here's rumor number 63, or is it 64A, about the mystery industry. Nearly all of the companies named in the earlier speculation will participate in a plan to put together a huge, life-sized model of the city of the future, depicting what life would be like in the year 2050, say. Walt Disney would furnish the ideas and put the overall package together." The specific details were off, but for Walt and the Project Future team, Wadsworth's rumor was too close for comfort. By June of 1965, Project Future had acquired over 27,000 acres of land, but the job was not done yet. Most of the large plots had been purchased, but to put the whole puzzle together, Disney still needed to buy up some smaller pieces. If Wadsworth's gossip turned into a credible story and was picked up by the national press, speculators might drive up the price, or worse, buy up the land and keep it for themselves. With Project Future on the line, Disney called again on Paul Helliwell, former World War II spy, to take on a new mission: kill the story by any means necessary. On the next episode of Business Movers, with the help of former spy Paul Helliwell, Walt Disney fights to keep Project Future a secret, even as he navigates a local labyrinth of closed-door deals, nosy politicians, and intrepid reporters. But Walt's biggest challenge isn't keeping a secret. It's overcoming a personal tragedy. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is episode 1 of Disney World for Business Movers. A quick note about our reenactments. In most cases, we can't know exactly what was said, but all of our dramatizations are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about Walt Disney and the Disney World story, we recommend Project Future, the inside story behind the creation of Disney World by Chad Denver Emerson, Married to the Mouse, Walt Disney World and Orlando by Richard E. Fogelsong, and Walt Disney, an American Original by Bob Thomas. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer-Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Once upon a beat! Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me,
DJ Future,
and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
Once Upon a Beat.